From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and this week we consider the vanishing beat reporter.
Two-thirds of audited daily papers do not assign a single reporter to cover the State House.
Someone would have got wind of this earlier had there been a reporter there.
As far as I can tell, just me and one reporter at the Wall Street Journal are the only full-time labor reporters at major newspapers.
When a newspaper assigned a reporter to a beat, such as poverty, they were saying this is important.
You know, local news trickles up to the national level. If you're losing these beat reporters, you're losing these people with institutional knowledge of what's going on in their cities. They're not.
This is just a prime example of when you turn away and you let something like this grow and it becomes sort of a cesspool of corruption.
Beat reporters, you don't miss them till they're gone. Stay with us. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For reasons that will become clear, we're starting this show with an old story. Back in 2010, the city of Bell, California, a tiny working-class suburb in southeast Los Angeles, was front-page news nationwide.
A state audit released today claims city officials mismanaged more than $50 million in bond money, levied illegal taxes, and paid exorbitant salaries.
The DA said they had 70 minutes of meetings over the entire year to bring down a salary of about $100,000 each.
And the California town with the highest-paid public official in the country and a quarter of its population living below the poverty line.
That is why they call it stealing.
The details were jaw-dropping. Over 17 years, city manager Robert Rizzo's salary grew from $72,000 to more than $1 million with benefits. Part-time council members and lower-ranking municipal officials drew compensation in the mid-six figures, squeezed from a largely struggling population of about 36,000.
You know, a homeowner in Bell, for instance, was paying more in property taxes than a homeowner in Beverly Hills.
Los Angeles Times reporter Ruben Vives was part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for unearthing the scandal. But if the paper had actually been on the scene all along, instead of neglecting Bell and other municipalities, it's likely the crimes never would have happened, because much of the scheme was perpetrated in public meetings.
But since no one was around, things got as bad as they did. Even for young reporters who are just graduating out of college, this is the thing you do. You go to a council meeting, you sit there, you try not to fall asleep. And you pay attention to what's being approved, what's being said by the residents. You know, someone would have got wind of this earlier had there been a reporter there. This is just a prime example of when you turn away and you let something like this grow and grow, and it becomes sort of a cesspool of corruption.
In places like Bell, the city government reporter has left the building. As resources dwindle for news organizations, among the first casualties of cost-cutting are the beats that were once the core of journalism's mission, holding the powerful accountable.
The media's inattention to Bell was not unique to Bell. In this hour, we consider the sorry state of the erstwhile backbone of the newsroom, the beat reporter.
Consider the story of scandal at the Veterans Administration.
Why is it that it took so long for this story to explode?
One of the problems is that we don't pay attention to beat reporters all across the country. There is a real value.
Or the depredations of Mexican drug cartels.
You know, local news trickles up to the national level. If you're losing these beat reporters, you're losing these people with institutional knowledge of what's going on in their cities.
These are journalism's ground-level watchdogs, sitting at school board meetings, cultivating police contacts, sifting through courthouse filings.
Reporters on beats are known as outside men. Since they work away from the office most of the time, every reporter must secure from the people along his beat a steady supply of the everyday happenings which...
When Hollywood constructs a reporter, it's almost always a beat reporter, a PI with a press card taking down the powerful. So intrepid and so glamorous in a sort of slovenly way, news organizations themselves have always played up the drama of the job.
Larry Menard, crime beat reporter. He has a full-time job covering stories that happen day or night. rain or shine. Crime in the cities and suburbs has increased. So has Larry's job. This kind of news happens without warning, but Larry's there.
But the spine of the business is degenerating. After talking with beat reporters over the past month, we heard again and again that their beats were being dangerously depopulated. The financial decline of the newspaper business, the birthplace of the beat system, left many of those reporting categories crucially undercovered, poorly covered, or not covered at all. Hey, Brooke, you know, I was a beat reporter once myself.
Do tell. What were your beats?
What weren't they? I worked in small papers in Pennsylvania and Delaware, medium-sized papers, and I covered the Housing Authority, the Redevelopment Authority, some school boards. I covered the police for a couple of years in Delaware. I covered, of course, a local concern called the DuPont Company.
Did you say you covered the crime beat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so give me an example of a scoop you got because of the expertise you acquired covering that beat.
The biggest, the one that actually got me the hell out of Reading, Pennsylvania, and got me a better job, was a brazen armed robbery. These guys held up a Sears store at the Berkshire Mall, broad daylight, Christmas time. A guard was shot to death. The guys fled but were quickly cornered, and the leader of the two, fearing going back to prison, put his revolver in his mouth, pulled the trigger, and that was to be that, except for the fact that the bullet hit the base of his skull, kind of did a half circle and came out of the front of his skull, effectively lobotomizing him. Off he went, first to the hospital and then to jail awaiting trial. He was facing a competency ruling to see if he could stand trial for this crime, and I, because I had all these connections with the cops in all these various jurisdictions, began hearing whispers that while in prison, he wasn't acting like he was incompetent in any way, shape, or form, and I got an interview with him, during which interview he not only discussed openly the details of the Berkshire Mall robbery, but another similar robbery a couple years earlier in a suburb of Philadelphia, for which he had never been suspected. He ended up getting a long prison term for that robbery that he inadvertently confessed to in my interview. How about you, your own self?
I started out covering a beat.
And that was State Department, Pentagon, NASA?
Strip mining. I was fired.
It's so funny, Brooke, because the first time I saw you, I said to myself, that's a woman who really doesn't know her strip mining all that well.
And so now, on to the rest of the hour, where we talk to a few people who have managed to hold on to their jobs, their very important jobs, against all odds.
As newspapers are figuring out where to cut, they're often looking at the State House and thinking, they really need this boring broccoli that we're feeding them about State House coverage.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You'd think that beat reporting has been fundamental to journalism since the birth of the business. But in fact, beats didn't really take off till a little over a century ago, when New York newspaper editor Charles E. Chapin of the Pulitzer chain sought to gain competitive advantage over the arch-rival Hearst papers. Chapin's paper, The World, published up to 9 times a day, initially without beats. But then one day, he had an epiphany. James McGrath Morris is the author of a biography of Chapin.
He had taken up residence in the Majestic Hotel and had taken a nap. Now, this is a period when telephones are still new. You know, how you ring somebody is hard. He finally gets through. Busy, said the operator each time. Anything happened? Chapin at last asked.
You describe it beautifully in the book. The operator goes, yeah, McKinley was shot.
Yes, she had gum in her mouth. Well, this got him thinking a lot more about telephones, and these were really coming into fashion. So the newsroom at The World had these phone booths that were at the end of the room, and they were labeled 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, Chapin began moving these phones. He put them at the city desk and eventually gave them to reporters. But what was important is he took a map of the city, and he drew a checkerboard pattern on it. And he said to each reporter, you're in charge of everything that occurs in that 3 or 4 block area. The idea of assigning people with specific responsibilities for geographic areas was already done in one sense. You had foreign correspondents who sent these languid letters. The Queen has been seen out and about, and the fog is lifting here in London. What Chapin did that really changed journalism was the idea of making the beat a source of facts, a source of information. And he created this rewrite desk of the star writers. And they would sit there with these telephones, and these beat reporters would file all this information in. And they were the ones who put it into the language that inspired people to pick up the paper.
The people who called in, mostly they were the staff of the paper, but sometimes it might just be an ordinary eyewitness, right?
Oh, frequently. You know, journalism was a very public affair. You would take your date down to Park Row, where all the newspapers were, on election night, and they would, on the front of the papers, buildings, they had blackboards, and they would write the news, and people would, by the thousands, would gather there. In fact, this was so popular that when the America's Cup race was waged, the Pulitzer newspaper had these small yachts, and they moved them across the building.
Little model yachts that they slid, depending on who's ahead, like a horse race?
They even did that with a famous boxing match, and they had marionettes reenacting the boxing match. And it was so popular, the crowd wouldn't leave, that they redid it another time. And I like to argue that's the beginning of instant replay. The point of all these anecdotes is that journalism was so much more central to people's lives. And so the development of the beat system in the Evening World was one of those innovations produced by the intense competition of that period, and it changed journalism.
What made beat reporting different, and how relevant is it today?
Beat reporting permitted these papers to develop peoplehood expertise. Writer Jacob Riis, who's really known for his photographs, was also a print reporter who made poverty in the Lower East Side his beat.
And wrote How the Other Half Lives.
Exactly. And he knew everything about what was going on. And so it gave authority to the newspapers. And this is also important to the transition that's going on in journalism at that time. Before that, journalism was an immature business. It was very partisan, often supported by political parties. And failed politicians became editors, and successful editors became politicians. It was two sides of the same coin. But when newspapers established their economic independence by writing copy that people wanted to buy, and if people bought a newspaper, you could sell pages of advertising. In conjunction with that was enormous technological change, paper that was strong enough to go through printing presses at incredible speeds, the telegraph delivering news from around the world. And the beat was part of that. It brought news that was reliable to the front page of the newspaper based on some form of expertise.
It's interesting that the beats that seem to be diminishing are those that are not close to the seats of power.
No, the change between when Chapin worked and today is incredibly dramatic. In his period, you could count in any small community in the United States that when the school board was meeting at 11 o'clock at night to vote on a contract, that there was at least one reporter in the corner of the room with a pencil and pad. One of the things that Pulitzer discovered as he became the most powerful publisher on the globe is that merely lighting the recesses of government has an effect. Even if they didn't file a story, they were there. The surprising aspect of creating beats, that was not its intention, but when a newspaper or a radio station or a television network assigned a reporter to a beat, such as poverty, they were saying this is important. And by covering it day in, day out, readers began to think poverty is important, and they began to press public officials to deal with it. The disappearance of the beats, particularly in those areas which are the least represented members of our society, is the disappearance of those issues from the public agenda. So the disappearance of beat reporting is far bigger than just merely a change in journalism. It has enormous civic implications.
Now, Chapin developed his own expertise. He became an expert in fostering roses, right?
He certainly did. Towards the end of his career, he murdered his wife and was sent to Sing Sing, which was the most notorious prison in the United States at the time, and spent the rest of his years cultivating acres and acres of roses. And his rose gardens became so famous that people like Harry Houdini, all these people came to visit him.
Is it true that he continued to edit the paper for a while inside the prison?
Not his paper, but he edited the prison newspaper. Almost every American prison of size had a prison-run newspaper, and he was its editor for several years until the state got upset with his style of editing.
Thank you very much.
Oh, glad to do it.
James McGrath Morris is the author of the biography of Chapin called The Roseman of Sing Sing. The number of reporters from regional papers covering the federal government has taken a steep dive. The Regional Reporters Association in Washington has about 70 members now, down from nearly 200 in the mid-90s. And with so many fewer eyeballs on Washington, whole agencies pretty much work unwatched. For example, one of the largest, the Department of Agriculture, has no mainstream newspaper reporters regularly stationed in its press room. There are no full-time reporters covering the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, haven't been for years. And according to a study by the American Journalism Review, the number of beat reporters on the Departments of Defense, Treasury, even Homeland Security fell by more than half between 2003 and 2010.
And so we'll take on three endangered beats. First up, the State House, where increasingly the sun don't shine.
Two-thirds of audited daily papers do not assign a single reporter to cover the State House.
Amy Mitchell is director of journalism research for the Pew Research Center.
That still is twice that of the local television representation. You know, local television is still the place that more Americans turn to for news on a regular basis. Only 14% of local TV stations that carry news assign even a single reporter to cover the State House.
However, a paper that doesn't have a reporter doesn't necessarily not have State House coverage. The wire services, principally the Associated Press, does yeoman's work.
About 14% of State House reporters are coming from wire services. One question that arises with that is the degree to which that content may be reported about at a broader level, looking across the whole state, rather than a very local perspective.
If legislation affects your local schools, but not, let's say, a majority of the counties in the state, the chances are that the AP won't cover it at all, let's say.
There's, you know, less of a watchdog role, if you will. We have seen in some recent survey data that the public's value of the watchdog role has actually grown in recent years. 68% say that that role that the press plays, they feel, has kept legislators from corruptive activities. And that's an increase of 10 percentage points compared to just 2 years prior.
Now, the same digital revolution that has played havoc with the business model of newspapers has also created opportunities for smaller online outlets to publish, and some of them fill in some of the gap.
These non-traditional outlets now account for a greater portion of full-time reporters than do local television outlets. In fact, the Texas Tribune, which is a nonprofit, has the largest bureau of any news organization in the country. 15 full-time and then 10 students.
Kind of apprentices. Tell me about students.
Well, we found about 220 students that are covering state government at any one time, and a number of journalism schools that are building this into their program. The University of Maryland, for example, University of Montana offers scholarships and credits for students to work with news organizations covering this beat. It can, in many ways, help assist the work that one or two full-time reporters is able to do for that organization.
Which is great. But almost by definition, these youngest of young reporters lack any of the institutional memory and maybe even the basic civics to do the job of an experienced State House hand. But something's better than nothing.
And that's why a working in combination may be the ideal way to do it, because not only are you able to get a few other people present in rooms, but you also may be instilling in these students a sense of the value or the importance of what occurs here on a day-to-day basis.
But then there's the state governments themselves, which have an interest, I suppose, in being covered. How have they tried to fill in the gaps?
The National Conference of State Legislatures used to bring together journalists to brief on a regular basis about legislation that was going to be happening across different states in the country. They'd have this conference once a year. And as fewer and fewer reporters started coming to that conference, they then switched and began putting out their own information and their own news services.
Of course, governments and government agencies covering themselves doesn't necessarily amount to sunlight.
Even the press secretaries themselves have said that the public isn't getting informed from this kind of content in the way that they used to do from more regular reporting that occurred inside news organizations themselves.
You know, Amy, I am old enough to remember when not only was there State House coverage, there was competition in State House coverage, which led to some pretty ferocious and wonderful journalism. I've got to assume that the competition factor has more or less disappeared from the face of the earth.
Well, it certainly disappeared in a lot of states. There's an example here in the work of the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, who are sharing resources. The bureau chief of the Herald told us, quote, "I think the absence of competition affects what our editors demand of us. Stories in the past they would want us to be all over. It's a little bit harder for us to make that sell now."
So less isn't more, less is less.
Less is less.
Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amy Mitchell is Director of Journalism Research for the Pew Research Center. Jeff Mytrot, a seasoned State House reporter for the Chicago Tribune in Springfield in 2007 and 2008, actually was in the right place at the right time to uncover the story of a lifetime. It centered around the state's governor, you know, the one with the super charismatic hair.
Yeah, Rob Blagojevich was just a wonderful target as an investigative journalist. I mean, this is a guy who couldn't help but make news no matter what he did, and often because he was just doing things that were pretty boneheaded and ultimately, as we proved, illegal.
You put together a team and a very robust investigation into Blagojevich's corrupt practices.
There'd been a story here, a story there that sort of kept mentioning the fact that insiders who were getting in trouble had given Blagojevich a $25,000 campaign contribution. And, you know, we were wondering, hey, was that what it cost to buy a favor from this government? It took me almost 2 months of research to painstakingly go through his public campaign contribution database, find the donors who gave $25,000, and then figure out who the principals were. It was a real connect-the-dots exercise. We found over 200 campaign contributions that were exactly $25,000, and 75% of those givers got something for their money. Big sort of no-bid contracts, state jobs, assignments to very influential policymaking groups, in some cases very favorable regulatory action from state agencies. So it was very nice to pull back the curtain and go, hey, here's the pattern, here's the bigger picture, here's kind of how the game is being played.
Well, what happened next?
Well, Blagojevich went down in flames. He was convicted. He went to jail. And it was somewhat satisfying that the article we did was one of the pieces of evidence that was used against him in his impeachment trial.
When the Chicago Tribune began to face its revenue crisis and they needed places to chop, you were kind of a star muckraker. So you're absolutely insulated from any kind of layoffs or buyouts, right?
That's what I've been assured of when I agreed to take that job and move my family halfway across the country.
But it turned out that was not the case.
I was the most surprised guy in Illinois when I got the phone call that Friday morning saying that my name was on the list and I no longer had a job at the Chicago Tribune.
What does this tell us about the state of nuts and bolts legislative coverage?
It says it's one of the most expendable items in the budget. And that as newspapers are figuring out where to cut, they're often looking at the State House and thinking, you know, we know they love our sports coverage. We know they're looking at our arts and our entertainment coverage. Do they really need this boring broccoli that we're feeding them about State House coverage? You know, it's stunning to me how what newspapers are supposed to be about, which of course is protecting the public interest, often takes a back seat. You know, a lot of us were the higher paid reporters. I don't think it had a lot to do with how well you were doing your job. It was how much money you were making and whether they thought there truly was enough reader interest to warrant that position.
Now you have moved your family again, this time to Minneapolis. You're working for the Strip. Are you so foolish as to believe that you're any safer in the Twin Cities than you were in Chicago?
I should know better. I had options, and I once again decided to walk through the same door. But the paper I work for now, they have 5 State House reporters. That's more than twice what we had at the Chicago Tribune, which is a much larger newspaper serving a much larger city. And I just think that speaks volumes about what this newspaper values. And when I found out that, that was a big sell.
Jeff, newspapers are all the time talking about how they value enterprise reporting, the kind of meaty stuff that begins with the initiative of the journalist. And yet, you have to know the beat before you can be enterprising.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It comes from that grinded out day-to-day coverage where you know what's going on. You know, I can say that with confidence looking back over all the things I've done as an investigative guy. I invariably pair up with a beat reporter, whether that's a State House reporter, a business reporter, a Metro reporter, who simply knows that subject so well and they've noticed something that raised bigger questions like, how is that going on? I want to go take a look at special education, or I want to go take a look at, you know, why kids are dying in daycare centers. That is where we do journalism that our readers really care about.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeff Mytrot is a national headliner and Loeb Award-winning investigative journalist for the Minneapolis Star and Tribune.
Now on to the labor beat. You might think that the number of union workers in the U.S. has plummeted in recent years, but the fact is, the actual number of unionized workers isn't down dramatically. The percentage of union members in the workforce is. In 1950, about a third of American workers were union members. Now it's roughly a tenth. And as the power of the unions declined, so has the number of labor reporters covering them. New York Times labor reporter Steve Greenhouse is still on that beat. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So the labor beat isn't dead, but give me an example of how it's currently limping along.
You know, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post all used to have full-time labor reporters. Many, many, many papers did. And now, as far as I can tell, just me and one reporter at the Wall Street Journal are the only full-time labor reporters at major newspapers. I used to go to the AFL-CIO's winter meeting, and when I first went around 1995, 1996, there must have been, you know, 15 reporters from daily newspapers. Now when I go to cover an AFL-CIO meeting in the winter, sometimes I'm the only daily newspaper reporter. There'll be one or two wire reporters and then, you know, 3 or 4 reporters from, you know, lefty newspapers that many people haven't heard of. The news media just don't think the AFL-CIO and unions are very important.
Some of the reason why they might think they're not important is the aforementioned decline of unions. And some of this can also be chalked up to the overall decline of papers, where there are fewer resources. So why put diminishing resources there?
A lot of newspapers devote a few reporters to cover the Dow Jones Industrial Average, what's happening in Wall Street. Investors are interested in that, but 150 million Americans, you know, go to work every day, every week, and they're interested in what's happening with wages, what to do about bullying bosses, you know, what happens if my company is not offering me paid sick days? Oh, pensions are disappearing. That's bad. What am I going to do to afford retirement? I think there are many, many important, not necessarily union, but workplace-related issues that, you know, millions of workers are terribly interested in, and I think they'd love to see, you know, their newspapers writing more about them.
Give me an example of a story that you saw and you wrote about because you were on the beat, something that a general assignment reporter might have missed.
So I flatter myself to thinking I'm a reasonably intelligent guy who keeps my ear to the ground. 2 years ago, I did a front page story about the growth of part-time work, and especially this very erratic, uneven scheduling where you might work 3 days a week and have a different schedule each day on the job. And that's creating havoc for workers, A, because they often don't get enough hours to live on, and B, that makes it hard for them to arrange to go to college, to arrange childcare, to take care of their ill parents. Because I follow developments in the field, I talk to a lot of people, I get ideas for stories that many others do not.
Are there some stories that are routinely being missed because there aren't beat reporters there to see them anymore that would have once been covered?
A few answers to that. I wrote a book in 2008 called The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. And the reason I wrote that book was, you know, back in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, under the Bush years when the stock market was at record levels, productivity was at record levels, corporate profits were at record levels, workers were doing very badly. Wages were more or less stagnant. More and more workers were losing pensions, were losing health care. And this was getting very little coverage in the news media. And I thought there's something wrong here, that this is a huge story, that there's a real disconnect between how companies are doing and how their workers are doing.
But you did say that some stories about the condition of workers has finally made it onto the front pages. And you've also observed that the number of labor reporters has ticked up recently.
You know, there's this huge labor story in Wisconsin when Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, tried to greatly reduce collective bargaining. You know, there was the big bankruptcy of GM, and could the UAW and General Motors figure out a way to get the company out of bankruptcy? Then we had Michigan passing a right-to-work law, and the bankruptcy in Detroit is a very labor-related story. Then Occupied Wall Street really raised issues about inequality, and now we have this big fast food movement where thousands of fast food workers around the country are demanding $15. And I think a lot of editors who for a while thought, hey, we don't need labor reporters. You know, labor is a dead issue. It doesn't really interest our advertisers very much. I think a lot of editors are seeing, you know, it's delinquent of them now not to have some reporter, maybe a halftime reporter, who's covering labor issues because they just keep pushing into the news. Some of the most emailed stories in the New York Times are stories about, you know, workplace trends, early retirement, discrimination in the workplace.
Do you think that there's the same aggressive reporting when it comes to covering the plight of undocumented workers, say, in the U.S.?
No, unfortunately. There are stories that I sometimes say, gee, I wish the news media had written about this. And then you'll see Colbert or The Daily Show do a very nice segment, partly because they think there's probably a vacuum of coverage in the mainstream news media.
Farming. It's the backbone of this country. But did you know it benefits workers of all sizes?
Children as young as 7 are legally working in U.S. tobacco fields.
Yes, according to a loophole in our agricultural labor laws, our hardworking tykes are free to pick as much tobacco as they
want. You didn't know about Samantha Bee's piece about kids in the tobacco fields, but you're about to come out with one yourself, right?
Yes, but we're not allowed to discuss it on the radio till it appears. I think a lot of what's happened, Brooke, is editors who grew up in the 1930s grew up living, breathing labor issues, union issues, strikes, the Depression. Editors who grew up in the 1970s, they knew much less about unions. They're just not interested in assigning union stories. Unions, you know, have a real challenge. They're often perceived as not very interesting, not very innovative. But I think that's changed somewhat in recent years with things like the Service Employees Union's Justice for Janitors campaign, where unions tried to reinvent themselves by kind of forming an economic justice movement. You know, this fast food workers movement, it's really gotten huge public interest, especially among millions of young people. And that's also getting a lot of coverage in newspapers, on TV, and on The Daily Show.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Greenhouse is the labor reporter for The New York Times.
What will be next? Can they not work out in the heat then, picking pumpkins? Can they not work out picking green beans?
First, they came for our child tobacco farmers, and I said nothing.
Because I had acute nicotine poisoning and was doubled over in pain.
You never appreciate a good job till you've had a bad one.
You're so right. Those children are going to appreciate the out of their next job.
Coming up, the last dying beat on our docket, the death beat, by which we mean obits of people who otherwise would never make the news.
You know, for the people who knew him, whether it was the people he shined shoes for at the airport or in the salons downtown, he was this really special, quiet but thoughtful guy. He did leave an impact.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's a saying from the early days of newspapers that goes, everyone gets to be in the paper twice, when they're born and when they die. The second part, the obituary, is, many think, a dying beat, specifically the obituary of people who otherwise wouldn't make the news. Jim Sheeler, a former reporter for the now-defunct Rocky Mountain News in Denver, won a Pulitzer for his piece about a Marine major who helped families of soldiers killed in Iraq cope with their loss. But before that, Sheeler was an obit writer. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
You say that obituaries written about everyday people are on the decline. Why is that?
Part of it is just the decline in space in the newspapers, and also that newspapers have seen obituaries as sort of a cash cow. The vast majority of obituary pages these days are paid family obits, and they're quite expensive.
It seems to be one kind of classified ad that Craigslist can't raid.
Exactly. Newspapers also charge to keep the obituary online. So you have to keep paying every year to have the guest book continue. So for families that can't afford obituaries, the kind that I wrote about mostly, those names might not show up in the paper at all.
And it seems that many regular people are either consciously or unconsciously writing their own obituaries through their social media. What can an obituary writer do that people aren't doing for themselves?
Well, there are some really fantastic self-written obituaries and family-written obituaries. But to get a sense of who that person was by looking through their scrapbooks and family stories and distilling that down into a real story that's not just interesting for the other family members, but to tell the readers why this life was important. One thing I always ask the family members is, what did you learn from this person's life? What can I learn from this life? What can I take away from it and maybe add to my own? How can I make myself better? One of the things I've said is that if journalism is a subsidized education, obituary writing is the philosophy beat. You know, it's where we learn about life and death and what makes up all of us.
But isn't it true that in many newspapers, the obit beat was regarded as the beat of last resort for fading journalists?
In many ways, it was. It was often referred to as the Siberia of the newsroom. I've saw journalists at my own newspaper punished. Obits for you for the next 6 months. But when I started writing them, I actually realized what a joy they can be to write. One of the first obituaries that came across my desk from the funeral home, that was in the days when they would just give you a little bit of information about the person, and it said, she was a florist and a butcher. And I was just like, I would have loved to have written this story as a profile. And then I realized, well, actually, I still can. That's the great thing about these obituaries is they're the last chance to tell this person's story. And there's a lot of pressure in that, but there's also a lot of reward. I would receive hugs after interviewing the families because they were so thankful. It's really cathartic for them. Now, we're so sort of scared about talking about death that a lot of people don't know what to say, and so they don't say anything at all. I was sitting with a man who had lost his wife to breast cancer. She was 44 years old. I had asked him that question about, what did you learn from her? And he recounted this story of how not long after she had been diagnosed, she was reading the newspaper. There was some inane story on the front page about politicians squabbling about some stupid issue. And this was right after she had been diagnosed. So she throws down the newspaper and she points at it and she says, you know, these people need cancer. Not enough to kill them, but just enough to make them realize what's important in life. And then he looked at me and he said, you know, Jim, it's not that there's too much cancer in the world. It's just that it's poorly distributed. You know, it's just absolute genius, you know, and it's not something that you would find by just calling somebody on the telephone. And that's something else about, you know, these obituaries. They take time. I did almost all of my interviews in person. With today's newspapers, where you're having to write several stories and live tweet and multitask so many ways, there isn't always the time to sit back and listen to the stories that mean the most, the stories that last.
Your Pulitzer Prize-winning piece, Final Salute, about the Marine that helped families cope with the loss of loved ones in Iraq. Do you think you could have done that without all those years on the obit beat?
Absolutely not. You know, I learned so much about talking to families, being there, knowing when to shut up and when to let them grieve and when to listen and how to listen.
What do you mean, how to listen?
people leave behind stories, and these stories will tell the obituary for you sometimes. One of the primary people in the story is Catherine Cathy, who is a 23-year-old pregnant war widow who I met just a couple of days after her husband was killed. When we were talking, she mentioned that she had taken up knitting when Jim was away at Marine Training Corps. I asked to see some of the things she had knit, and she took out this baby blanket and she told me its story, which was that the night before Jim left for Iraq, he knew that he wouldn't be back in time to see the baby born. So he slept with that baby blanket because he said that when the child was born, he wanted the baby to know how his father smelled. And that was the lead of my story the next day. The soft blue-green baby blanket still smells like Second Lieutenant James J. Cathy. I mean, that's so different than the standard, you know, news story. Writing obituaries taught me how to look for those stories in places like a baby blanket.
One more example of precisely that. You took the shortest obit in the paper and you reported it out. Johnny Richardson.
Just said basically that Johnny Richardson had died. He enjoyed listening to jazz. There are no survivors. When you have no survivors, they basically take things that might mean something. They put them in a box in the public administrator's office. And so I went down to the public administrator's office and I found all of his belongings basically fit in a box the size of a shoebox. And I started reporting from letters and things that he had left behind. He had shined shoes at the Denver International Airport for decades. You know, for the people who knew him, whether it was the people he shined shoes for at the airport or in the salons downtown, he was this really special, quiet but thoughtful guy. He did leave an impact. In the salon where he ended up working downtown, you know, they left a memorial on his shoeshine seat. And here he was about to go completely unrecognized and without a grave marker at all.
So he had an impact. Did your work have an impact?
Yeah. After the story ran, they raised enough money to actually buy him a headstone. And when I go to Denver, a lot of times I'll say hi to Johnny in the cemetery.
Most of us are not famous. Most of us just pass through. And that's the coverage that is disappearing with the obituary of the regular person. Since we're such a narrative-driven form these days, why can't we keep this going?
There are still reporters who are out there doing this. Andy Meekum at the Tampa Bay Times is one of the best obituary writers writing today, and he does many of these. He calls them epilogue. The problem is that it does take so much time to sit with these families and listen for the stories. They don't always come out in the very beginning. You know, you have to jump through a lot of cliches. You know, people will say, you know, he would have given the shirt off his back to help somebody. And, you know, I always would challenge them, well, did you ever see him give the shirt off his back to help somebody? And at one point, though, one woman said, well, actually, I did see her one time we were walking along and she took off her shoes and gave them to a homeless person. And so that's the beauty of these obituaries is they're not the cliches or the eulogies, they're the stories. I mean, we're all made up of stories. And trying to find those last stories is one of the most important jobs in the newspaper. I think that because of the time it takes and the money it makes to not do them, that's one reason they're fading away.
So, Jim, we're going to do an obit of someone who hasn't had one written about him or her. Do you have any pointers about how to go about it?
You know, I would just call up and say, I just read this small little thing that the funeral home sent out about your loved one, and I know there's a much bigger story there. Would you have time for me to come and just look through some scrapbooks and tell some stories? And almost inevitably, they would say yes. A few would say no, and I'd never pressed it because I've made it clear that I was going to tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. I did stories about people who were jerks and whose family members admitted it, but that made them who they were, and it made those stories really wonderful. You notice a lot of things when you're scanning the obituary pages every day. Mm-hmm. The husband that dies hours or days after his wife. Mm-hmm. Some amazing love stories on the obituary page.
Well, that sends us on our way. Jim, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Jim Sheeler is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and now a journalism professor at Case Western University in Cleveland.
Good luck with the obit.
Okay. We're joined now by OTM producer Chris Neary, who produced this hour on Disappearing Beats. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Brooke.
You took notes?
I did.
And you found Bruce Bray, a person who died a few years ago, who lived a couple of hours from you in New Jersey, right?
Right. And the small obit that ran when he died is pretty intriguing. He was young, and he was a renowned children's magician. So I went down there and talked to his mother and to his best friend.
The original obit? That was all it said, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah.
Let's hear about the life of Bruce Bray.
Bruce W. Bray Jr. performed the rolling egg trick on the White House lawn more than once. And one time, Jennifer Lopez was performing on the stage next to him. Later, he did magic at a kid's birthday party at James Gandolfini's house.
Jesse Eisenberg starred in this movie, Now You See Me, which was about a band of magicians. When Jesse was interviewed, they asked him where he got his love of magic. And he said it was from a magician named Bruce, who performed at his fifth birthday party.
Jean Bray had five kids. Bruce was the oldest. He had no interest in going into construction like his father. He never went to college, never worked at Starbucks, never had any interest in doing anything other than magic. He started when he was seven. A lot of kids go through a magic phase. His went on for 35 years.
One of the tricks he did was cut me in three pieces. That was at his first show, and it was for the ARC program, which is adults that are handicapped. And it was really comical because after the show, all of them came up and they were touching me all over to see if I was back together again.
After high school, Bruce gave himself 2 years to make it in the business. At first, he wore a classic clown getup, a big red nose, the whole thing. When he got more confident, a tuxedo. When he became so well known in North Jersey he was turning down work, just a nice shirt.
He did shave his head, and he liked that look better than having a receding hairline. It was very vain.
Was he very vain?
Yes, he was vain. But, you know, he's a performer.
Bill Ford was Bruce Bray's best friend.
His eyelashes, every girl that walked up to him, that was the first thing they made a comment on.
His eyes just popped out of his face. From the time he was a baby, he had those great big eyes.
He performed without a stage. Living rooms and backyards in Jersey were his theaters. He did tricks with names like The Coloring Book and The Donut and The Tuxedo. That was when he stood behind a kid, slipped his arms under his shoulders, and performed a trick so it looked like the kid was doing it.
It was everywhere!
And the kids would scream and scream and scream. So much that he's had several times where kids would pee in their pants during the show. And I always told him he should use a slogan, pee in your pants funny, but he wouldn't use that in his advertising.
He used to say he performed for children because they were less skeptical and more enthusiastic than adults. You could say the same of Bray.
That's not red. What color is that?
Yellow!
We've got a yellow ball and a red square. You know what that means?
Bray drove a van with his picture painted on the side, but he never lived more than a few miles from where he was born. He loved Mexico, though. He'd planned to move there. His Spanish had almost gotten good enough to do magic shows.
He could go down to Mexico and just be walking the streets and people would recognize him and go, Bruce Bray, Bruce Bray. You know, a lot of people knew him down there.
In May 2010, Bruce Bray fell down a flight of stairs.
Then he had a traumatic brain injury. They were concerned about the swelling of his brain and ultimately had to do a craniotomy on him where they removed the whole front half of his skull. And at that point, his head just swelled from the brain swelling. Eventually that did come down and then his head sunk in like a soup ball. And it was 6 months later, they finally put the skull back on because they felt it was safe.
Bruce Bray stayed in the hospital for 13 months and endured more than 30 procedures. Jean Bray and Bill Ford made sure one of them was there every day for an 8-hour shift. Bruce didn't talk once the whole time.
One time I took up some animal balloons and I blew one up for him and just handed it to him and he just automatically went in and made a dog. Like, he did still have something there, but it was not enough, I guess.
Bruce Bray died in 2011 at the age of 43 at the Hartwick Rehabilitation Center. He was a magician. For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
I take the red ball, I put it inside this hand over here. On the count of three, the red ball disappears. It's right over here inside this hand. What?
The hat!
Oh, so this hand. No, just watch his hands. One, two, three, it's gone. Did you see me put it in my pocket?
Yes!
Well, that's not fair. These guys are smarter than the kids in South Jersey.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sara Abdurakhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimi Regler. We had more help from Kasia Mikhailovich. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippin.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.